de un apartamental pulga infestado vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. ¡It's Batsegando!
Jorge, I wonder if you could actually answer a question for me. How do you say in Spanish, my head is like an imploding volcano, and I am in a world of pain? Kids, this is Bat Segundo once again for another show. I am prying myself off the floor, and I am in pain. We have two guests this week. Our first guest is Amanda Filipaki, whose recent novel Love Creeps is a comedic romp in New York about stalking. I can relate to this issue. You see, back in my FM radio days, my agent told me that I would need to have at least three people stalking me at one time. Stalkers, he said, would give me credibility with the 18 through 34 demographic, which, as we all know, is the lifeblood of radio advertising. It would make me hip and edgy, whatever that term might mean. So, he took out an advertisement and I began to live my life in calculated fear. I lost a lot of money paying these stalkers, and the stalkers didn't really do their job. I was able to go to the liquor store without incident. There was no heavy breathing from the people who called me on the phone. Not long after this, I was blacklisted from every major radio market. Kids, there's a moral somewhere in this tale. I don't quite know what it is, but I am grateful that Miss Filipaki reminded me of these dark days, and that our young roving correspondent talked with her instead of me. Perhaps it was good for all parties that they talked by phone. Anyway, I'll let the correspondent's interview speak for itself.
I wanted to ask you, why stalking? Have you ever been stalked, or what was your interest in the subject?
Well, I've only been, not really stalked, but, you know, there was someone once who called me on the phone, and he played a kind of a trick on me, which I guess some people do. Mm-hmm. He called, and I said hello, and he said hi, and I said, who is this? And he said, guess who? He said, I don't know who, and he said, oh, come on, guess. So I said, Sam? He said, yeah, so how have you been? And, you know, Sam was the brother of my boyfriend at the time, and we had just had a big fight, so I thought he was calling me to find out about the fight, so I told him all about the fight for about half an hour. And then he became a little bit lewd, which really surprised me that my boyfriend's brother would act this way. And anyway, I finally realized it was you know, it was not him. And then he tried it again another time, and I think I came to the conclusion it was my accountant.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So I guess you've kind of sort of in this book, Love Creeps, you've almost sort of legitimized stalking to some degree, in the sense that you've sort of taken the risk out of it, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think because I've never really experienced it on mm-hmm. a serious level, I was able to just deal with the humorous side of it. But I really think if I had ever been seriously stalked, I would never have written about it this way. I think it must be one of the most horrible things in the world if
yeah.
it really happens to you. And I had always been interested in the topic of obsessive love, not necessarily, you know, to the degree of stalking, but even I saw a movie when I was a teenager. It was the story of Adele H. With Isabella Gianni. It's based on the real story of the daughter of Victor Hugo.
Mm-hmm.
And she was completely obsessed with a soldier, and she stalked him, and it was sort of, she became insane at the end.
Huh.
And I always found that very interesting and very frightening, you know, the thought that this could happen to anyone, that they could become so obsessed with someone. I was almost more afraid of the possibility that this could ever happen to me than, you know, and that I could become like that, than that anyone would stalk me.
Well, this kind of touches upon sort of a theme throughout your work where you have characters sort of engaging in this really sort of intense or extraordinary behavior, whether it's stalking or locking someone in a cage and teaching them acting lessons. What is it about this? What draws you to this type of behavior?
Well, you know, as I said, it's just strong emotions. I also like, you know, kind of original themes, like the locking in the cage and forcing you to make your own dreams come true. seemed like a kind of a, I hadn't seen that done before in movies or books, and sometimes I mean, I hesitate to say this because I wouldn't want it to happen to me, but sometimes a part of me almost thinks, oh, I wish someone could make me write more, or, you know, anything I want to achieve, because sometimes I just don't have the willpower myself to achieve it.
I wanted to note that you're actually one of the few people who has actually earned the wrath of Harriet Klausner. Are you familiar with Harriet Klausner?
Yeah. I've earned her wrath.
Well, I mean, she actually, you know, she seems to like everything, and she's quite prolific in her reviews, but she called...
She gave me 5 stars.
Did she? Well, I mean, it said, she said that you were satirical but somewhat inane. And this kind of reminded me of sort of Damon's instructions to Anna, like, do, you know, satirical but somewhat inane.
I know, but nevertheless, she gave me 5 stars, and overall that review is very positive.
Yeah.
I mean, from what I remember.
Well, just see,
I do remember being slightly offended by that inane word, you know?
Yeah.
But she's a strange reviewer, because when I saw that I had gotten 5 stars from the number one reviewer on Amazon, I was very excited. But then when I dug deeper and I looked at the other books she's reviewed, she gives 5 stars to everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe in this case she's just so in the custom of giving 5 stars to reviews that, you know, I don't know.
Well, yeah, maybe she gives 5 stars even when she dislikes the book.
Yeah, yeah. But I kind of wanted to touch upon, I guess... some reviewers I note have sort of compared your work to chick lit, which, depending upon who you talk with, is either, you know, a positive word or a negative word. Would you characterize your work like that, or do you consider chick lit a stigma? Or do you consider your work chick lit?
Yeah, no, I don't consider my work chick lit, and I don't like the term very much, but. But then a little part of me thinks, well, if it improves sales, maybe.
Yeah.
I should like the term, but I don't think it's chick lit at all. And I think anybody who likes chick lit would probably be very disappointed if they read my book hoping for chick lit.
For me, it seems sort of a strange term, because it's, you know, anything that sounds like a, you know, a gum, you know, it's something that is, you know, cause to be concerned.
Yeah, no, it's true. But I don't think I have been called chick lit very much or even at all. I mean, sometimes I guess I'm reviewed along with other books that perhaps are chick lit, but that's the extent of it, I think.
I wanted to sort of touch upon a few of the themes in your book. First of all, I wanted to find out, how do you plot out your books, or do you plot out with your books? Because the sense I get when reading your work is that basically there's this sort of like really fast-paced kind of comedic energy, and a lot of ideas sort of just seem to crop up in the course of the narrative. And I'm wondering how you sort of maintain this sort of spontaneous flow, or is it something that you plan, or is it something that you sort of kind of – you just go ahead and sit down and write and just sort of let whatever ideas that strike your fancy kind of engage on the page?
No, it's a very thorough process. I'm really thorough, which is part of why it takes me 6 years to write each book. I make a lot of lists, and I make lists of every possibility for every aspect of the novel, including, you know, the plot, the events, the scenes, the characters, the character traits, the personalities, the motivations, everything. And even when I come upon an idea I like, I usually don't accept it right away. I continue the list until I make sure there isn't another possible idea that might be even better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I come up with my stories.
Okay. So you essentially kind of run with this sort of list of ideas, or?
Yeah, for example, for Vapor, I like to, you know, plan the whole plot, everything, before I actually begin writing.
Mm-hmm.
So for Vapor, I had hundreds of pages of notes for the characters and for the events before I even began the book. And it can be a very tedious process.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes fun, but sometimes tedious.
Art seems to figure very prominently in your 3 books. You have A Painter and Nude Men, you have acting in Vapor, and in Love Creeps, you have art dealers, and you also have a nod to the independent film where Alan becomes a star. And I'm wondering if why art and culture seems to loom large within your books?
Well, because I'm a writer, which is an art, I guess I feel I can relate to other arts more easily than other professions. So I just tend to pick, I often pick other arts and write about characters who are involved in them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, when you're a writer, I mean, I guess a lot of writers have had a lot of professions, but I haven't. I've basically just been a writer. So that's one area where, you know, I can't write from my own experience when it comes to other jobs. And although regarding the art aspect, there's also the fact that I did grow up with a lot of art in my house. My dad was a collector. He was very into surrealism, and so that influenced me a lot. In fact, the cover of Vapor that I wanted for the cover was a painting I grew up with that I think really inspired me for the story of Vapor.
Uh-huh.
It's a cloud. It's a Magritte painting of a cloud that's going through a door, and that probably gave me the idea of, you know, a house filled with little clouds.
Your novels sort of also have kind of an innocuous approach to the politically incorrect. You know, Nude Men, you have, you know, a man having an affair with an 11-year-old. You have people sort of casually stalking other people. You have, you know, people, of course, thrown into cells. And has this approach been an issue with editors or your publishers? Have your editors sort of like said, hey, Amanda, can we get more, like, you know, craziness, or have they actually asked you to tone things down, or have you actually had to tone things down?
No, I know in Nude Men, I originally had just one sex scene, you know, mm-hmm. with the young girl, and my editor felt that I should add more sex because there's a big build up towards that, and then the reader might feel a little bit cheated that there's only one sex scene. So I ended up writing a couple more sex scenes, and one of those sex scenes turns out to be my absolute favorite section of Nude Men. So I'm happy she made me do that. But regarding people who are shocked or upset, that didn't happen too much. I mean, it did happen when they flew me to Holland, uh-huh. and I was on this big TV show in Holland, and there were some members of the audience, some mothers, who got upset with me. It's great. But anyway, to answer more your question about the politically correct, I guess I've sometimes questioned, you know, the fashions in our society and, you know,
yeah.
rules that we set up that seem sometimes to me a little bit arbitrary. I know that when I was writing Nude Men, I was still very young. I was like 21. And I remember feeling that, you know, why isn't it okay for, you know, children or, you know, young teenagers to have sex. I think now I'm 37, so I think I've maybe altered my view a little bit.
Sure.
But that's kind of why I wrote that book. And in fact, you know, I was very surprised. I recently had to go to Holland for this literary festival, and someone told me that Nude Men was taught in their high school.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess things are done a little bit differently over there. So.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to basically touch upon how you use trios as a sort of mode of conflict, where one person alters another person, who in turn alters a third person. And trios are very much sort of the I unfortunately have not read Nude Men, but I did read Vapor and Love Creeps, and trios seem to me a very sort of central kind of component, a sort of device that you used. I'm wondering what draws you to that device. Will we be seeing doubles from you? Or
it's funny that you mentioned that, because someone asked me the very same thing recently,
mm-hmm.
and I remember I was thinking, that's not something I was ever aware of on a conscious level, that I wrote about trios, and I didn't even know exactly how to answer that question. And before you interviewed me, I was hoping you weren't going to ask me about trios. But,
well.
So I guess it's just, you know, it creates interesting situations, interesting possibilities for stories.
Well, it also sort of evokes the menage a trois.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect. Maybe do you think that might be sort of a subconscious factor, given that your work is very sort of love-centric and intense-centric and sex-centric?
funny because actually after I wrote Nude Man, I started writing a novel about a ménage à trois, which I then, you know, dropped. But so I guess I must, on some subconscious level, I must be interested in that topic, even though in real life I've never been interested in a ménage à trois or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, you said in an interview with Columbia Radio that you're not afraid of going mainstream, but let's say that you did actually get, like, a large printing. Would you feel that maybe your voice might be compromised, or can you sort of elaborate on that?
Yeah, no, I don't think a large printing would compromise my voice. I mean, my voice is my voice. It's just going to be the same whether it's a tiny printing or a big printing, but... Maybe you mean for future books after that,
yeah,
would influence how I write. It's hard to say for sure, but I don't think so. I mean, I would like to have more readers, basically, you know. I write for people. That's why I originally started writing. When I was 13, I decided to be a writer because I loved the feeling I had when people would read my stuff and really like it.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the more people I bring that good feeling to, the better.
I found that a lot of your characters are sort of middle class or upper middle class, and they have a lot of spare time on their hands. I was wondering if you would sort of maybe if you – why you there's this sort of like kind of class distinction among the characters, or it has just this been sort of a natural kind of thing to gravitate to, or is why this particular sort of social milieu?
Well, I think, well, Alan is an accountant, so he's not, he's definitely not upper middle class. But it's true, he does have a lot of free time on his hands. I guess a lot of the subjects I'm interested in writing about require free time on the part of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, that has been an issue. Sometimes I've had to think of ways to justify it, and which means often the characters end up doing very badly at their job because they're not showing up there very much.
Are there any sort of efforts that you're making with perhaps future projects or future works to possibly address this issue, or?
No, I mean, I'm probably going to keep on writing the way I have been. I don't think it's been... a big problem because, you know, I always justify it somehow that, and some of my plots don't always require the characters to have that much free time. Just so happened that with stalking, you do need a lot of time to stalk.
Sure.
So, I had to make the characters do badly at their job in order to be able to stalk. But, my new novel is going to be about a circle of friends, and most of them are artists, and, well, that's an advantage with being an artist, is that, you know, you have a very flexible schedule, you can take as much time off as you need to, or not.
Thank you very much, Miss Philip Hockey. Our second guest today is Kevin Smokler. Despite the name, I understand he has never smoked a Garcia y Vega cigar. He is a writer in San Francisco and the author of Bookmark Now, which has nothing to do with bookmarks and everything to do with now. In fact, while reading the book, I actually lost my bookmark and was forced to resort to a bottle of Dewars to keep my place. I was unsuccessful. Anyway, the book is a collection of essays about the reading issues of our time. There is, in fact, one steamy piece that should be listed in all MFA promotional brochures. Anyway, our correspondent talked with Mr. Smokler about the publishing industry, reading, and he stammered too much for an aspiring professional. We here at the Bat Segundo Show will be signing him up for Rotary International, and we apologize for any listening inconvenience.
First off, I wanted to ask you, have you recovered successfully from your book tour? Or?
I think so. You know, it's a downtime right now. I've got two speeches to give in Vancouver next week, mm-hmm. And then my girlfriend and I are going on vacation for a week.
I was going to ask about vacation.
Well,
how it factors into this, like you seem to be in every single town these days.
Yeah, well, I sort of told my publicist, I'm like, all right, unless Terry Gross calls from the 11th to the 18th, I'm not available. And I mean, I don't know if I'm going to be able to resist if something tantalizing comes along, but I doubt it will. The book's been out for 2 months now, and I think everybody who's wanted to take a crack at it has. I just got an offer to do a couple of things in L.A. I was in L.A. in June, and I'll probably be back there in September or October. And then October, because it's book festival season, is just going to be insane. I'm going to 4 book festivals in October, so I'll be gone every single weekend in October, and I have 1 gig here in town in November. And I've promised both my girlfriend and my agent that come Thanksgiving, I'm done with Bookmark now.
I was about to ask
if on to the next thing.
2007, Kevin Smokler still very much on tour for this first book.
No, it'll be time to move on after that. At that point, I will have decided I've done what I can do, and it's time to start something else.
Well, anyway, I wanted to first talk about Bookmark now, but some of the issues you raise. I went to Book Expo America, and one thing that really sort of struck me about that experience was learning that the publishing industry is stuck in 1995.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they see blogs, for example, as, like, marketing devices instead of, like, you know, actual conversation or alternative journalism. I was wondering why you think most publishers are sort of disconnected from this sort of online culture. Why do you think this is?
It's several reasons. One, there's an attitude that I think persists mostly among the older generations of folks that work in publishing, that the computer is something antithetical to reading books, that the that what we do online is in fact in direct competition with the act of reading an actual printed book, and should therefore be avoided or minimized or demuted in some way, that we don't have to pay much attention to it, because it would be like you know, a hat manufacturer paying attention to a glasses manufacturer paying attention to the laser eye surgery industry, for example.
Gotcha.
But amongst the people coming up, I think the people who books would who this kind of technology would benefit the most from are usually publicists and marketing people, and in fact authors who are, you know, ignored mid-list authors who would benefit from doing some of their own publicity. A lot of those authors are not simply wired that way, because it requires a different set of skill set than writing.
Yeah.
And two, I think the young publicists are simply overworked, underpaid, understaffed, and have their superiors telling them, okay, this is what you're supposed to do to publicize a book, and that's 60, 70 hours a week.
Yeah.
And the ones who have the energy and the time and the drive to explore new avenues of how to get books in the hands of readers are few and far between, unfortunately. It's usually people who are like you and like the other lit bloggers who are not directly involved in the industry.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, though, I've started to see, like, there have been some publishers who I've corresponded with who are very receptive to the lit blog thing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if you saw the reading experience lately, but James Wood actually popped in, and this great argument. And then he quoted the Elegant Variation thread in one of his articles recently. So now there's sort of a slow legitimization of both lit blogs and sort of the online culture.
Absolutely. I mean, things are changing, no question about it. I mean, it may not have been evident from something as sort of big and as traditional as Book Expo America, which is like a world's fair for books. But I think it's things are definitely changing. And the publicists who are regarded as the tops in their business are the ones who recognize that. Someone like Lissa Warren at DeCapo, you know, who wrote the book on the Savvy Author's Guide to Publicity, is also
Amy Greco at Viking is extraordinary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, a couple of Catherine Zuckerman at Knopf, you know, the folks at Unbridled. I mean, these are the people who sort of
Richard Nash of Soft Skull.
These are the people who not only recognize the potential but are not coincidentally considered the best in their industry.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of talk about this. The podcasting and lit blogs, for example, are very hot right now.
Yeah.
Do you think that these sort of serve as trends of the day, or, you know, how does this kind of online culture, which is consistently evolving, how does a publisher go ahead and access that the very nature of the evolution if it's not enduring, because they're talking about 2-year book cycles?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I guess if we are seeing with lit blogs have emerged, yes, but podcasting has emerged. It could be a long-term thing. It could be something that's like a flavor of the month, much like, you know, vlogging is kind of moves in peaks and valleys.
Right.
So with such a shifting atmosphere online, how can publishers, which exist in very long sort of cycles, how can they access this or deal with this or interface with it, so to speak?
I think, you know, the ones who I think for something that is as cheap and as inexpensive as podcasting or as blogging, there's no penalty for being the first out of the gate. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at KCRW, the public radio station in Los Angeles, you know, obviously they are a very well-funded, well-established public radio station. They were pretty much the first out of the gate to do podcasting, and they're being richly, richly rewarded for it now. WNYC could have been the first. KQED could have been the first. KEXP, that's sitting on $10 million worth of Paul Allen's money,
yeah,
in Seattle, could have been the first, but they weren't.
Yeah.
And they're playing catch-up right now because KCRW looked at the radio space and said, we've got great programs, and we have the potential to have an audience way outside of Los Angeles if we make it available to them easily.
Yeah. Well, even like West Coast Live, I noticed they don't have their shows archived, and I listen to them on the radio.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It would be great if they had all their archives online, like other sort of sites, even locally produced things.
Right. Right. I mean, unfortunately, I think it often requires. Expense and funding and persistence of vision that a lot of these places just don't have or can't afford.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't take much for – it might take much for Random House's publicity department to say, okay, we need a new media initiative. But it doesn't take as much for someone like Soft Skull, who isn't benefiting from traditional media attention in the first place, to be creative and to be innovative. Where is it going to come from first? I have no idea. But to me, it only takes one good hire or one radically thinking publicist or one author with a comfortable advance and a decent brand name to go ahead and make it happen. I mean, it could be a David Mitchell or a Jonathan Franzen or someone. I mean,
well, the other thing, too, is that you often go to these sites. Like, we had on Return of the Reluctant, there was like a discussion about Christopher Sorrentino and Trance.
Yeah.
And how if you actually go to the Farrar website, mm-hmm. all you get are these listings of, like, you know, dates and places. No information about who Christopher Sorrentino is.
Right.
He may as well be some weird – I suggested that he was a performance artist who sets his penis on fire or something.
Yeah, he could be. I mean, who knows?
I mean, you know, it tells you nothing about the book.
Is there a ChristopherSorrentino.com or is there an independent
trans website? No, there isn't.
This is – you know, I got an email – you probably got the same email like 3 months ago from the FSG publicity department saying this is the book to pay attention to. I mean, maybe stupidly, perhaps they think that because this book is getting all sorts of pre-publicity in the traditional media that they don't need to bother with the
That's exactly it. And I know that there were efforts to approach conventional media, traditional media. But, you know, I know that I was very interested in the book. I was certainly interested in his father's work.
Yeah.
And I know that other lit bloggers I'd corresponded with were also interested in the book. And it's sort of like, well, if you have people who are genuinely interested in talking with Christopher Sorrentino, not only that, but, you know, the publicity. I didn't know that he was at the Booksmith, and it's my neighborhood bookstore.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
No, it's just, you know, it's just dumb. It's dumb and it's short-sighted and I hate to say it because I love their books, but FSG has always had this problem.
Yeah.
FSG, I once compared them to the Howard Hughes of book publicity. They're tremendously well-funded. It's a very well-respected brand name, and they're just secretive as all hell.
Yeah.
I mean, what they're up to and how to – it took me years to figure out how to get books out of FSG.
You know, it took me 6 weeks to get I Am Charlotte Simmons, and it came in my P.O. box after the release date.
You could probably buy it on the remainder table for $2 before, you know.
Exactly.
And it probably would have been worth just as much of your time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's really, I mean, it's to think of the internet as some sort of minor league in terms of publicity is just dumb because we have a whole generation of readers coming up now where that's where they get their information about arts and culture, and to ignore that is to ignore the future, and the future is here sooner than we think.
The next generation of writers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your book, you sort of focus in on McSweeney's. But I guess sort of the interesting thing about the McSweeney's thing is how that particular tone has kind of adopted into writing of all sorts, even blogs or journalism, the sort of like the obsession with 80s pop culture and the first person plural, the, mm-hmm. you know, Donald Barthelme's influence.
Right.
I guess the question, if you see that sort of as a clear sort of future of publishing, what about the other voices that are not particularly McSweeney's? How is the variety kept alive online or, you know, outside of McSweeney's? I mean, you know, there are other venues like Softskull, for example.
Yeah. I think the major media doesn't have room or a peripheral vision for something much more than, okay, we need to find the new voice of publishing and literature. This is it. And, yeah. and we don't have room to say there are three or four of them. We just have room to say this is it.
Yeah.
But you know, I think Bookmark Now does a decent job reflecting that it's happening in other places. You know, it's happening in places with people like Tom Bissell, who does write for The Believer, but is also a fairly traditional literary writer that also that does this kind of overseas journalism.
He turns down a woman for a video game session. I don't know if I would do that.
Yeah,
but
and
you
it's
know,
crazy yeah. about video games. Yeah. You know, I think I'm actually fascinated by authors who have fairly traditional literary aspirations and yet still find themselves flying 10,000 miles overseas to file, you know, news stories. Volman yeah. does this as
yeah.
well, which
yeah.
I think is neat. I mean,
yeah.
it's there's something very sort of Hemingway 1930s about that, or
yeah.
or Edward R. Murrow about that. I find really interesting. The other, I mean, I think we don't have it so much in this book. I wasn't able to get someone, but Paul Flores is a little bit reflective of the fact that there's an entire new generation of African American
yeah.
and Latino literature coming up that is highly influenced by hip hop music, highly influenced by spoken word poetry, and I think the publishing industry has done a decent job of ghettoizing, but is making a lot of good crossovers. Authors like Danielle Smith, authors like Ture. Authors like, you know, Victor Laval, who just won this big award last year. I mean, I think that's a good example of it. I think I'm really interested to see who, you know, sort of the younger brothers and sisters of Anil Stevenson are, you know, the people who have grown up awash in this kind of technology.
Well, China Mieville.
Yeah. And what kind of, you know, what they'll bring to the
yeah.
table, you know, the younger brothers and sisters of a Stevenson or a Gaiman or So I think there's a lot of things to look out for. Will the mainstream media focus on more than one at a time? I doubt it, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't.
You have an essay by Neil Pollack where he retires his voice,
yeah.
and you have one involving Pamela where she sort of finds her voice.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing, though, about the current sort of publishing atmosphere is you have authors who now must sound as articulate as Martin Luther
right.
King, and who
right.
also must be, you know, photogenic and telegenic.
Right, right.
And how now you're seeing this sort of atmosphere drifting towards the cult of personality,
right.
towards looking good, sounding good,
mm-hmm.
being, you know, there's the, you know, for example, the Susan Orlean cover
yeah.
is just utterly ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
I'm wondering
you're talking
why
about the cover of which one? The Bullfighter.
The Bullfighter, yeah,
or the
exactly.
My Kind of Town
well,
cover.
Yeah,
the,
well,
her in the saucy black suit cover.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. I mean, you know, the identity and voice is certainly sort of a factor, but I'm wondering why you sort of refrain from this cult of personality, which seems to me a very disturbing kind of development. Because, well, what does how one person eats tell you really about an author? You
know? Right, right. I mean, it would be very nice to believe to say that wasn't relevant, and I would like to believe that too.
Yeah.
You know, but it is. We live in a visual media saturated culture. Should it be relevant? No. But I don't see it taking away from the value of what those authors produce. I mean, I don't think Susan Orlean is less of a journalist because
yeah.
they happen to put her in some silly pose on
yeah.
the cover of her book. Now, if your follow-up question is, okay, what if Susan Orlean was 60 pounds overweight, 15
yeah.
years older, you know, spoke badly in public, couldn't stand up for herself at a book or
yeah.
her work at a bookstore? Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately the way we market books right now is so sort of single channel and unimaginative that yes, that's gonna the industry right now is going to naturally shy away from authors who can't do those things.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I think that's good because I think we live in a dangerous world where when artists feel that they have no need to dirty their hands with the contact by connecting with people who pay their livelihood. On the other hand, I think it reveals a birth of imagination in how books are marketed. In
well,
other words, we have to say, you know, if an author can't speak well in public, do something else. Maybe send a CD beforehand at the bookstore
yeah.
of them reading or something like that.
Well, the other thing, though, is that what of, like, the Corbett McCarthys or the James
yeah.
Salingers or the Thomas Pynchons
yeah.
who refused to have anything to do with the public?
Yeah.
You know, I would hate to see those voices compromised in this sort of recurring sort of process.
Sure. I mean, I think if those guys – I mean, you know, the opposite is Dickens and Twain, who couldn't get enough of the public.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think the talents of any of those authors would have been compromised if they were forced into a publicity position that was uncomfortable for them. I don't believe that. I think McCarthy would be just as powerful if he had to go on a book tour, or if someone at gunpoint told him to go on a book tour, for example. And the other thing is, you know, each of those authors is from a pre-internet, pre-cable TV, pre-CNN.
Well, except for John 12 Hawks.
Yeah, sure. Generation. There's that consideration as well. I do not moan the loss of the reclusive author. I don't. I don't think we're going to get any less worthy literature out of that loss. And I don't believe that. And I believe that artists owe the people who patronize them something. You know, it used to be one nobleman in the court of Versailles, and now it's a million people. So, yeah.
We had a bit of a sort of discussion at the Elegant Variation with Paul Collins.
Yeah.
I wanted to sort of, you know, touch upon this so I can understand exactly where you stand on the Reading at Risk report. Now, basically, your sort of concern is with the definition of reading in this report.
One of them.
I'm just trying to understand the reasoning here. The report is presenting statistical information that sort of shows a drop in reading.
Yes.
And you sort of object to the conversation that results from this.
Yes.
In terms of like the fact that it's a problem or a crisis, I was wondering if you could sort of clarify this. I've been curious because, I mean, it seems to me that if there is a statistical drop in reading, that this is a sort of, you know, a problem that needs to be sort of focused upon. You know, what specifically? I mean, I'm just trying to understand the tone of your introductory essay here.
Oh, absolutely. I don't believe. I don't know the first thing about government research, and I don't know. And I am content to believe. And Paul and I disagree a little bit on this. I am okay believing that the NEA did its due diligence from a methodological point of view, and collected and put together a report that where the findings are significant to some degree. Quibble about how they got to those findings, that's not of much interest to me. What made me angry initially is the conversation that followed, which seemed to be the same old song and dance we've been hearing for 50 to 75 years surrounding American culture, which is that it's new media's fault, it's the kids don't appreciate it, it's the utter moral bankruptcy of our age. You know, this is the same crap my parents were hearing when they were listening to rock and roll in the 60s, and the same crap their parents were hearing when jazz came along. And before that, it was the dime novel at the turn of the century. And, you know, this is the same old argument that some fundamental aspect of our culture is collapsing, and it's all the barbarians that have gathered at the gate in the last 5 years whose fault it is, and it's just nonsense.
Well, but at the same time, though, if it's a significant problem, I mean, you know, and perhaps there is a good deal of alarmist over the problem,
right?
But, you know, in terms of evading the fact that a problem exists in which reading is down, more books are published more than ever, sales are down. I mean, this is a significant problem, wouldn't you say? I mean, how will the book survive? Maybe the book will certainly survive,
yes.
But it won't survive in nearly perhaps the figures that we have had in the past. So, you know, what in terms of avoiding thinking about this problem, you know, I guess I'm just confused, because it seems to me, you know, enthusiasm is fine. Yes, the internet exists.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, there are graphic novels.
Right,
there are
right.
alternative medias. Yeah. There are spoken word performances. Mm-hmm. But the very sort of nature of reading, if this is compromised, if this is at risk, I mean, you know, it may be the risk, it's the question of the level of risk, but, you know, I'm just curious how the essays in your book sort of find a solution to this problem.
I mean, the point of Bookmark Now, of course, was not to find a solution to the Reading at Risk report.
Yeah.
The Reading at Risk report came along a good year into the production of Bookmark Now. So
yeah.
it was not in our consciousness when the book was sold and put together. The second part of your question, though, is if it is a very real problem, let me see if I've got this right.
Yeah.
If it is a very real problem, what do we do about it?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think what I think what we don't, let's start with what we don't do about it. What we don't do about it is bemoan the moral bankruptcy of the age and say, oh dear, the sky is falling, because it doesn't work. It doesn't help. And all it does is, turn our focus inward instead of outward. What do we have to do? I think we have to get creative about how we market books. I think we have to make authors more accessible to people. I think we have to turn reading into less of a school-bound activity and more of a leisure time activity. I don't think we talk about reading nearly enough in lifestyle journalism. I think the publishing industry could have seized the whole, you know, live simply movement. What's living simpler than reading a book? I think we think of reading in this culture in a very narrow, elitist way. And Ed, you and I know as well as anyone that reading, while edifying and intellectually satisfying, is also an object of great joy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we... I don't think that's the foot we put forward when we speaking of you and I don't think that's the foot we as a society put forward.
Yeah.
And we should be. It's... If you think William Gaddis is the cat's meow, if William Gaddis makes you want to dance and sing, I say, God damn it, dance and sing.
Yeah.
Might not do it for me, but I'll go dance and sing about Nicholson Baker or Dorothy Allison or whoever makes me dance and sing. But we got to dance and sing because people are dancing and singing about the White Stripes and Grand Theft Auto and the new Star Wars movie and Jim Jarmusch and 100 other things.
Well, the other thing, though, let's talk about Harry Potter and mm-hmm. how this factors in.
Yeah.
We were talking about elitism earlier, touching upon that.
Yeah.
Now, I would say that when it comes to I'm a populist, but simultaneously, when it comes to reading, I'm a bit of an elitist, okay? I have no problem, you know, laying out the cards.
I wouldn't take that away from you.
I cannot read a beach book. I'm sorry.
Right.
But, you know, well, Harry, here's the question about how this translates into sort of what we're talking about, which is reading.
Yeah.
Harry Potter... Obviously, everyone's reading this thing, but at the same time, there was actually a letter in the Sunday Times mm-hmm. by Terry Pratchett, who was sort of saying, this is not fantasy. A fantasy is not limited to this sort of like, you know, who dies at the end of Harry Potter. Is it good for people to be just reading, or should there be some sort of standard? I mean, how are standards set if, you know, the bar is set so low? And how can one sing and dance when it's something, in my view anyway, Harry Potter? No, give me like Gormenghast, you know?
Sure,
give me Mervyn Peake.
Yeah. I mean, no, I think reading as a high-toned literary reading, as an intellectual as well as leisure time pursuit, has always been a minority activity. You know, I mean, since there has been a novel, that has been a minority a minority of society activity. We are not going to get to a point where David Mitchell is more popular than Paris Hilton, much as we would all like that to happen. He simply doesn't have the gifts, natural and otherwise, natural and media reach wise, that Paris Hilton has.
Well, he also doesn't have the video of him in the green light.
Exactly. So
maybe that might help. I don't
right.
know.
I mean, but I believe that we all have to read. I believe we all have to read what is good for us and what speaks to us. I believe we have to make good books as available to people as possible. The Iliad, for example. The Iliad is a great tome of Western literature, which it is. But fundamentally, the Iliad is a book about a guy who goes to war because someone else steals his girl, and it's really a book just awash in bloodshed. It was the Freddy and Jason of its day.
But I don't think that, you know, Homer was intending for you to reduce the work down to a log line.
No, of course not. But, you know, we got to give people a point of entry.
Yeah.
We can't just say here's 1,000 pages and here's a free Sunday afternoon and go for it. I mean, I think you got to start somewhere.
Well, though, how do you get someone reading those 1,000-page tomes? How do you get some starry-eyed student excited about literature and reading, say, Volman or something?
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think you can do what McSweeney's does, which is make it cool and make a sort of a clubhouse out of it. I think you can. You know, there's a Trivial Pursuit question, actually. It's a great Trivial Pursuit question, which asked, you know, what did Irish radio play consecutively for 72 hours, you know, and it was a reading of Ulysses, you know, and they made it reading Ulysses as an event, you know. A teacher of mine from high school went to the University of Toronto, and every year they had a Ulysses festival, where everybody would go sit in a room with a bunch of junk food, and you would pass Ulysses around, and you know, you'd read however many pages you could read until you were tired of it, and then you'd pass it to the next person. It was all allowed, and it lasted, you know, it was like camping out for concert tickets, except it was reading Ulysses, and it was a rite of passage at being at the University of Toronto. I think that's a great way to expose people to something like that.
But with dwindling attention spans and sort of like the whole Harry Potter thing where it's like, I have to read, you know, this 600-page book, you know, in less than 24 hours before anybody else, reading becomes sort of a spectator sport, or a major sort of sport, rather than an actual sort of, you can't sit there and process it. And I guess it's sort of, I guess my concern is, you know, for books that are more difficult, for books that may have literary value,
right,
where do these fall within sort of, you know, the paradigm of reaching out to other people? I mean, can a 72-hour Ulysses read actually exist in the 21st century?
I don't know. I would hope so. It can exist in the 20th, but, you know, I would hope so. I think we have to be imaginative. Simply saying something is good for us will not work. That's like telling someone they should eat broccoli. And I can't eat broccoli unless I saute it in olive oil and put some garlic on it, you know. So I think we need to have these great, if these great works of literature are great, we've got to do more than say take my word for it. We have to say this is why they are great, and this is what you can get out of it. And if we have to reduce the Iliad to a log line for someone to pick it up instead of Paris Hilton, then that's what we have to do. I don't think that diminishes for a second what is contained within the Iliad. It just creates a wider door for someone to walk through to get there. Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe easier for the Iliad than for Infinite Jest or something like that.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, the recognitions, I don't know if you can even put it into a log line.
Sure.
You know, I also wanted to talk to you, blogger Ron Hogan of Beatrice. He noted that the essays in Bookmark now, while enjoyable, and I enjoyed them, didn't necessarily match up with the intent of writing in unreaderly times. Do you think that the sort of the tagline of your book is kind of lives up to sort of its purpose, or could you describe its intention, or can you maybe respond to Hogan's claim here?
I'm actually glad Ron said that.
Yeah.
The simple truth is, when you're putting an anthology together, you can give people instructions, and most of them will disobey you.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, you have to go where they are willing to take you, because you know, you got 25 busy writers in your book, and they have their own muses and their own agendas, and you can and they will normally follow them before they will follow you. Does it live up to it? I think so. I think the book is meant to be impressionistic rather than an argument. I think it's meant to be revealing of a state and a time rather than a sort of point by point dissection of that time. Mm-hmm. And I think it lives up to that part of it. Yeah, I think so.
Writing about video games as a diversion is actually, you know, does that describe the act of writing? How does this sort of, you know, relate to the issue that you present in your introductory essay? I guess that's sort of the question that Ron had, and I sort of had to some degree, you know.
In the case of Tom Bissell, Bissell is saying, I have two great loves in my life, and they're John Updike and Grand Theft Auto, and I have managed, as a literate person, to embrace them both with equal fervor. I choose one as my hobby and one as my way of making a living, but they are my two big passions in life. And I think what that essay reveals is that one can have both. And being a great reader and choosing to pursue a literary life does not mean choosing to exclude the other digital diversions of our age.
Okay. So it's more than it seems to me. I mean, my take on the book, anyway, mm-hmm. is sort of that it's more of a generational. I mean, your original title is Generation Text.
Yeah, it was.
You know, and it's. Is it more. I mean, I guess I'm just sort of trying to understand why it's writing in unreadably times and not say, you know, Bookmark Now, the revelations of the next literate generation.
Mostly because I determined that unless something is written by Douglas Copeland, your publisher won't let you put the word generation in it. They find it alienating to people.
Really?
Yeah. Well, this is what I was told. They say to themselves, this is the sense I got. I wasn't told this directly, but the sense I get is that if you say a generation something, then it says this book is only for people of that certain age.
Even the greatest generation.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, that had Tom Brokaw behind it. But I don't know. I mean, I wasn't interested in Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation. I figure I can call my grandfather if I want that information. Huh. But
so they wanted to expand the demographic, and that's why this sort of subplot.
No, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think what they want. I think what they wanted to do was make it about now, was make it about the time rather than the people. Mm. And the fact that this group of people is the spokesman for that time simply means we selected a group of people that are at the crossroads of this change that's happening in the book business right now.
Okay. I gotcha. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go back to reading really quick. Now, I guess, sort of the reading evangelist here.
Yeah.
You said, for example, in other interviews that you have rereading 10-minute installments.
Uh-huh.
There's other people who, like myself, I have a tendency to read, in 3-hour installments or something like that.
I admire the hell out of.
I guess the question here is, since reading is sort of an individually framed kind of task, mm-hmm. how then can it be promoted among, you know, a sort of a wide group of people?
That's a good question. I think what we ignore as readers is reading is a solitary activity, but the celebration of reading is a public activity. Mm-hmm. See the, you know, One Book Chicago, One Book San Francisco, see the Lit Blog Co-op, see the, see 100 other things. There's nothing more fun if you are a reader than getting together and talking with other readers about what you've been reading. That is a part of the reading experience we do not emphasize enough. We tend to frame reading as a solitary activity, which it is. But there's a reason people form book clubs. It's because as soon as you read something, particularly if you read something you like, you want to tell someone about it. How do we promote reading? I think if it is in fact as individualistic as it is, I think we emphasize the groupedness, that's not a word, but emphasize the cohesion of it. I think we emphasize the fact that the community forms around reading, and we emphasize the fact that in an age when people are feeling either subconsciously or barely on their conscious disconnected with people, I think we emphasize that reading is a great way for people to find one another.
Well, the other thing too, and again about the online mm-hmm. culture, is that, you know, you have declining book review coverage in newspapers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people, you know, there's someone in Gary, Indiana who, you know, I believe has like the highest homicide rate in the nation.
Yeah.
You know, what about someone there who they can find a book, but where do they find other people?
Absolutely.
They find it online. But at the same time, you know, where was I going with this? I guess I was just trying to sort of suggest how the individual merges with the group if the individual is based in somewhere like Gary, Indiana, or in some sort of, you know, youth hostel in the far reaches of Uruguay or something.
Yeah, I mean, I would have asked the same question, you know, I would have asked the same question before I found out there was a music scene in Omaha, Nebraska, but apparently there is, and, you know, and apparently you had two or three, it doesn't take that many people, you had two or three people, you know, playing music, and maybe one of them was a DJ at the local college radio station, and there you go, that's a scene. A scene needs about a half dozen people to become a scene.
Takes a village.
Yeah, how do we... I was thinking of the article that was in the Chronicle recently about the donation that the group of prisoners at San Quentin made to the Salinas Public Library.
Yeah.
And they all said the same thing. If I had had a library and books available to me when I was in my wild days, I wouldn't have ended up in prison.
Are you familiar with the bibliotherapy that went on in San Quentin in the 1960s?
No, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, that's where Eldridge Cleaver's Soul and Ice came out of that.
Yeah.
Basically, San Quentin during the 1960s mm-hmm. had like this phenomenal program. This one warden was like a very, you know, he believed in the power of books to sort of, you know, reform minds.
Yeah.
It was incredible. Like every 90% of the prison population there was like literate.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's remarkable.
And they were all writing their own books and like they were getting book deals.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think it has enormous, not only obviously redemptive potential like that, but reading allows people, particularly people who feel underserved by the information machine that is our society, to feel like they can keep up, to feel like they can be participants in the conversation. And I think that's enormous. You know, obviously we have to give them access to the tools, and the tools may not just be books, but I think books are a great place to start. You know, I mean, I've every time I'm in Baltimore, I go and visit the book thing, which is this, which is just the basement of some guy's row house, and he brings in free books, and once a week he opens it up, and anyone who wants to can come by and take it. Now you'd think it would be people like me, you know, trying to score a free copy of I Am Charlotte Simmons or something like that. Actually,
well, you wouldn't want to, but
yeah, exactly. It's actually mostly people from churches, schools, prisoners' families groups, mm-hmm. homeless shelters. And those are the people that show up 3 and 4 hours before the book thing opens to get their free books because their clientele can't afford to go to the movies. They can't afford to, they can't afford 32-inch television sets. These are.
But conversely, when you sort of create an environment like our San Francisco Main Library, which shifted to this suddenly sort of electronic sort of thing, and now it becomes this haven for all these homeless people rushing in the early morning to go ahead and check their email accounts, and it's not about books anymore.
No, and it's amazing how much the locus, how much a locust of change the library is right now. If you 10 years ago, you couldn't have imagined a more staid, frozen in time institution than the library, and now the library is where it's at. It's where it's all happening. How do you make it more about books? I don't know. I mean, what I would say, like I've talked about this with my local video store. I've said, hey, you should get together with Booksmith, and every time an adaptation of a novel comes out, you should offer a coupon for the book. Mm-hmm. Booksmith, conversely, should do the same every time a novel gets made into a movie. Books are one part of a very large multimedia feast that is available to all of us. And I think in order for it to be a significant part and a relevant part, it has to be in communication with those other forms. The book will not survive if it's seen as this island away from culture, as something, as you know, book people are not also movie people or television people or video game people.
Yeah.
If we take reading as the sort of totemic indication of an educated person, I think there's huge potential in that. I mean, the Bravo Channel based its entire business model on that. You watch Bravo because you're an intelligent person.
Well, are you familiar with the American Film Theater series in the 70s?
Yeah.
Where they basically did filmed versions of plays with big-name actors who worked for scale. And it was this, and they basically were able to actually bankroll this by selling a subscription to the movie-going public as if it were like theater. You know?
Absolutely. Or, you know, my mother grew up in, you know, Tenafly, New Jersey, going to Leonard Bernstein's Concerts for Kids mm-hmm. in the 60s and developed a lifelong appreciation for classical music because of that. But I'm telling you, when she went to Leonard Bernstein thing, she wasn't required to dress formally or to sit quietly in her seat or to not munch popcorn or any of those things. Leonard Bernstein knew that the only way classical music would survive into the next generation was if you made it fun.
This is something Ting Lally wrote.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with the acknowledgement thing.
Yeah.
She said it would be, you know, you have Nicholson Baker in your acknowledgements page. But she said to me, you know, she said in her post, it seems creepy to strike up acquaintance with someone just so that I can later thank them in my acknowledgements. this, I mean, can you sort of respond
to
this?
Sure.
Are you going to acknowledge me in some future book?
When I met Nicholson, writing a book was a gleam in my eye. I hadn't even considered writing a book when I met him. When I met him is back when I was doing Central Booking. He was the first person I ever interviewed, mm-hmm. and he sort of his friendship and openness with me opened the entire world of book reviewing and interviewing authors and the accessibility of the publishing industry, which I didn't think existed for me at least before that time.
Yeah.
So that's why he's in there. I mean, we exchange emails, but we don't visit each other at Christmas or anything.
Okay.
I happen to like his books, but he was really the first major author who gave me the time of day, which is why he's in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Kevin.
Absolutely, Ed. Thank you.
Coming next week, what do you do if you have a headache that won't go away for 14 years? Find out next week on show number 5 as Jorge's voice pierces into my skull and yours. Thank you once again for listening. Now excuse me while I go and polish off this bottle of Merlot. Ugh!